This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, attorney Jay Lederman joins us to talk about his representation of information hacktivists. He's defended members of Anonymous and other individuals you may not have heard of, who've been targeted by the government with tactics of harassment and over-prosecution. New York City attorney Abi Hassan joins us to talk not only about hacktivists, but also about journalists, whistleblowers, and other information activists that need legal protection as they're severely prosecuted by the government. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Long before news reports of Russians hacking the Democratic National Committee dominated the news, a handful of lawyers across the nation were defending socially minded hackers, or hacktivists, against harsh computer-related prosecutions. The term hacktivism refers to persons who use computers to advance political agendas, often related to freedom of information, free speech, and human rights issues. The Atlantic magazine has called attorney Jay Lederman the hacktivist's advocate for his work defending individuals accused of computer-related crimes, especially those associated with Anonymous. An experienced defense attorney, Lederman lectures nationally on a range of criminal defense issues. He is a founding member of the Whistleblowers Defense League, formed to combat FBI and Justice Department tactics of harassment and over-prosecution, to chill and silence those who engage in journalism, internet activism, or dissent. Jay Lederman, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Jay, you're one of the nation's top attorneys for individuals accused of violating the Federal Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, or the CFAA. Tell our listeners about this 1986 law and how prosecutors are using it.
The CFAA is a very antiquated computer law that essentially criminalizes any action that a prosecutor would want to criminalize on a computer. For example, the U.S. attorney just put out a policy statement that simple violations of terms of service won't be prosecuted or shouldn't be prosecuted. But under the CFAA, you can make a good argument that checking like your eBay account or something like that on your work computer when that's against the policy of your employment would potentially be a violation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. And, you know, a hard-charging or malicious prosecutor could, in fact, bring that charge. And they carry with them, you know, between 5, 10, some even 20 years of exposure, and they stack on top of each other. So each count is another, you know, 5 or 10 or so years. It's a very frightening law, and I like to refer to it as a horse and buggy law in a jet plane society. And the reason I do that is because this law was authored in 1984. The people in Washington swear it wasn't authored as a response to the movie War Games, but its proximity to the release of that movie, along with the way it was written, certainly tends to indicate that, you know, they saw that movie less as entertainment and more as a documentary. And just to kind of go back over sort of computer history as it relates to that really briefly, HTTP protocol came online in 1991, and that's what we have today. That's the modern, you know, fire up your browser, type what you want into the search engine, and there you go. You know, the great big shopping mall that is the internet. Before that, there were basically, like you saw in the movie War Games, you would take your phone off the hook, put it down on a modem, and then, you know, you dialed up where you wanted to go, you know, Stanford University, MIT, DARPA, what have you. And the difference between the two is everything. You know, this law was drafted for sort of a nighttime burglary, like, you know, one of these, you know, what we hear of is as these CIA sort of like black ops that took place in like Watergate and all of that, where, you know, people break in the middle of the night and go through files and things like that. That's what the internet would have been like in 1986 when this was authored, all the way through to 1991. And you can see this statute making sense then, because you're dialing up a particular place, like a standalone building, and going in the middle of the night, dressed in all black, with the intent of rummaging through the files. So not the case anymore with HTTP protocol. The internet is a mall and a repository of information, and you know, a crime on that is much more akin to a shoplift than it is to some nighttime burglary.
And yet, in the body of cases that we're seeing, from Aaron Schwartz to a lot of the people you've represented, to Jeremy Hammond, these cases, these actions are being treated really as issues of national security with really draconian punishment. What efforts?
Well, they are.
Yeah, and what
they
effort,
certainly are.
What efforts, Jay, are underway? I want to talk about a few of your cases, but clearly the CFAA needs reform. What efforts, if any, are underway to do that?
None. Absolutely none. There's discussion about reforming it upwards, and by that I mean Senator Lindsey Graham put forth a proposal last year to increase penalties for the use of a bot, you know, a machine that holds zombie computers. Like, you know, people say they download a virus. Sometimes you're downloading a Trojan, and you don't know that your machine's being used for some type of attack. He wanted a 20-year, you know, to expand the law and put a 20-year punishment on that. And fantastic organizations, you know, led by the EFF, and the ACLU, and there was a coalition, I think, of nine of them, have worked to stop that. And those are the organizations that have really been proposing rational and sane changes. And thus far, nothing's happened. The most impressive effort was Aaron's Law, which was, in fact, in response to Aaron Swartz's tragic suicide, when, you know, he was facing, some people say he was facing 35 years under some of the proposed indictments they had. It looked like he can go as high as 100 years, which is hysterical.
And listeners should know that his alleged crime was downloading a large quantity of documents from JSTOR with higher than regular speed, so that
right.
Technically he was in violation of the user agreement.
That's exactly right. Yeah, and JSTOR ultimately backed off the request for prosecution. MIT did not, which is why they went forward. But yeah, JSTOR is the repository for academic scholarly research. It's behind what they call a paywall, meaning you would have to pay, even though the research is by and large publicly funded, you would have to pay to access these scholarly articles. So Mr. Schwartz developed a script that allowed the downloading to take place faster, and he had essentially the permission. He had user access via MIT to all of JSTOR unpaid, and what he was doing was trying to liberate the articles from behind the paywall to in front of it. All that, and, you know, in the end, he was looking at 35 years, and they wanted to give him 6 months actual and make him a felon.
Right.
And, you know, whether it was a day or and a misdemeanor, it was still too much for the actions charged.
And Aaron's case, I think, sends a lesson intended by the government and corporations to send a cautionary message to so-called hacktivists. And I wanted to talk just briefly about the hacker ethic and what so many other young people like Aaron are doing with the goal, really, of preserving a free internet, fighting for democracy and open information. Recently, journalist Matthew Keyes was sentenced to 2 years in prison related to a hack of a newspaper website owned by his former employer, the Tribune Company. And you were on his defense team. Can you tell us about that case briefly?
Yeah, I sure can. The allegations surrounding that, I hesitate to even call it a hack, and I'll explain why. You know, the allegations surrounding that case involved the use of a lawful credential, so something that your work gives you, you know, a pass, a login to get onto their system. Journalism has something that they refer to as a CMS, a content management system. Some people call it the back end of a website, but it's essentially what allows you to put content up that is seen by the front-facing web page that, you know, people go onto the internet and log on and see, you know, for example, a story on the LA Times. Matthew was convicted of passing a separate login credential. So he's accused of, there was sort of only an inference in the evidence that he took his credential and bumped it up to what they call a super user, so a specific key, as it would be, to a key that opens all doors, and passed that to a member of Anonymous. And that member of Anonymous took a really like a back page type, you know, nothing story from the LA Times website and changed the title of it to put a joke in the middle of the title. It was about Democrats saying that they may need to consider a tax hike and you know, something to the effect of, you know, the Democrats need to shut up. For that, he got 2 years.
Do you think that there's a particular animus directed by the government toward anything related to Anonymous?
I do. It's unquestionable. Not only is it unquestionable, it's not something the government denies. You know, they think that to the extent that people are involved in hacktivism, people are involved in unlawful activity, and they don't distinguish between the two. And you made a point in passing earlier that with some of these people, they see them as threats to national security, and that's beyond question.
One of the things that struck me in Jeremy Hammond's background, and I'm sure this is not uncommon, is that when he was young, Jeremy hacked into, I guess, the local Apple store, found some errors, displayed them on in their store, and then offered to help them fix the vulnerability that he discovered. When he was in college, a similar thing happened, and he was, as they say, not invited back. With so many really intelligent, I'll call them technical tinkerers, how much of this is embarrassment? You know, a lot of information activists, you know, believe in open source. They want to share their learning experiences with others, and that seems to me consistent with the really lofty notions of an open and free internet. But we see many of them turned down for their efforts to do good by corporations when they discover vulnerabilities. Do you see that a lot in the cases that you represent?
You do. One of the better examples of that, although not the world's most sympathetic defendant, was Andrew Orenheimer, who goes by Weave. What he did was he and some other folks found a vulnerability in the original iPad. And essentially, they gave everyone with the original iPad a website for their, you know, for their interaction with Apple, which is a really insecure way to do things in that it wasn't login and pass protected. So if you figured out, for example, that, you know, the first iPad off the line went to, you know, some of the names that were in there were, for example, like Michael Bloomberg, New York City, former New York City Mayor Michael
right.
Bloomberg. And if you assume iPad number one went to him, it'd be like, you know, www.AT&T.com, you know, /iPad/, you know, and the number one, and number one would be Michael Bloomberg. Well, what they did was figured out that if they had changed the last numeral to number two, you know, that would be Diane Sawyer, and number three would be, you know, whomever else, on up to about 120,000. And when AT&T didn't care about this and didn't fix their patch, they turned all of this over to pretty positive it was Gawker.
Mm.
Yeah, I want to say Gawker. In any event, they turned it over to a media outlet, at which point he was promptly prosecuted and sentenced to, I think he got 41 months, and he served about 19 of that before his conviction was overturned on unrelated grounds, grounds related to jurisdiction.
Listeners will recall that Jeremy Hammond was arrested in conjunction with the so-called Strat4 hack, an intelligence company. He was also part of LulzSec, related to Anonymous. Jay, I know that when Jeremy Hammond was working with his legal team to put together his defense, he was in detention and had very limited access to computers to really go through mountains of information over several years. How does that hinder an individual's ability to put together a proper defense in these kinds of cases?
Well, the first thing I think we have to look at is the fact that there is absolutely no ability to have a speedy trial in situations that are like that. You know, first it took, in Jeremy's case in particular, it took months and months and months and months before he was allowed to put his eyes on anything. And, you know, he was he essentially had instruction from the court to, well, have your lawyers print it out and they can go over it with you and then remove it when they leave. And, you know, that doesn't work. People much smarter than me that deal with computers have put it like this. You know, a 500 gigabyte hard drive filled with information, if you printed it out on paper, can go, you know, could potentially go to the sun and halfway back. That's a decent amount of paper. So eventually, it was Judge Preska in the Southern District of New York was persuaded that perhaps he can look at the stuff on CD with his attorneys. And in visiting where he was, they did have computers, and he was able to sit there and look at the materials. And it's only at that point could you really tell which, you know, for example, what experts he thought were needed, what witnesses he thought might be useful in his case. And this is, you know, now you're talking about a year, year and a half after the arrest, you know, and everyone's wondering why these cases take so long. Well, he's not even laying eyes on it to that portion. And it's like, I don't know how many DVDs worth of or CDs worth of discovery it was. They're usually on DVD. So, I mean, if you can imagine the amount of data, his case in particular was very heavily dependent upon what they call chat logs from, you know, internet relay chat sessions where people are just going and going and going and going. So you have, you know, some chats, if they last for a couple hours, are, you know, hundreds, maybe a thousand, maybe a couple thousand pages, you know. 20 people in there, everyone's typing, you know, they're it's supposed to be people, you know, the typing is like talking, but everyone's talking over each other. You know, you have, that's just one chat, and this is something that was collected over, I think, from like June to at least December of 2011. So you can imagine how many chats, you know, occurring on a daily basis that was, and what a daunting task it was just to read those things by the defense attorneys and then try to have to explain them to Jeremy and then have him try to read them in the limited time he was allotted with those computers. It's not like he was given a, you know, they give him a laptop in his cell and said, hang out, have fun. So, you know, it becomes very difficult to find the little nuggets that you're going to need for your defense when you're working in such a manner. And in Hammond's, ultimately, it was, you know, it was pretty much impossible. And they maybe that was a reason why it made more sense to take a deal.
Right.
Was that the case was going to be so hard to both prosecute and defend that it kind of it settled in a fashion that I think made neither side happy.
Right. I was also struck in the case of Silk Road. Ross Ulbricht was arrested and is serving a long sentence in connection with running the dark website called Silk Road that sold illicit drugs, where Ross Ulbricht got a really harsh sentence. I heard one of the attorneys say that they felt in the courtroom the jurors could not fully grasp the concept of the so-called dark web. And I would imagine that with the antiquated laws, with the prosecution claiming national security and, as you say, making petty entry cases more like armed robbery, it's very easy for jurors to fall sway to what the prosecutors are claiming.
Well, I think it's a combination of two things. One, yes, that the people just off the street don't have a great understanding of the mechanics of computers and the way the web works itself. But when you're talking about the dark web, a lot of people haven't even heard of that. And if they have, it's just, you know, it's not something many people know of. So clearly that's a problem in terms of getting it expressed what this is. But even worse with Ulbricht is you had these chat conversations like in Hammond occurring on the dark web where they're even obscured more. And the allegations in Ulbricht and the reason he got such a harsh sentence dealt with murder, solicitation for murder, murder for hire type situations that they attributed some back to Ross. And he could have received, I believe it was a 30-year sentence or a 30-year-to-life sentence, and ultimately the judge imposed 30 years to life. Don't hold me to the numbers. They may be a little different, but his tail was life on that. So he won't even be eligible for parole for, let's say, 30 years.
Right, that's right. There were those other factors in the case. We just have a few minutes remaining, Jay. We want to know what predictions you have about how the Trump administration will treat hacker cases or hacktivist cases over the next few years. Will things get harsher?
Well, yeah, I would expect things to get harsher. It's an interesting question in that it's asked at a really interesting time when, you know, perhaps topping the news right now is the Russian hacking scandal and this idea that people are putting forth that perhaps Trump's victory was less legitimate because it was he either, you know, conspired with the Russians in some manner, as some, you know, people have suggested, or that he at least was the beneficiary of Russian hacking. And I think there's going to be no handling of hacktivism going forward. There will be no thought of hacktivism, you know, perhaps on the individual level of prosecutors, but not in a global scale. Hackers are going to be seen as hackers, as threats to national security, as compatriots of foreign governments, and flatly as terrorists. And I've seen one of my clients end up on the terror watch list, and I would be expecting in the next 4 years to see a lot more. Childish fun, exposure of information, the curiosity that builds the hacker ethos, the scientific curiosity, are going to be ground in the gears of the prosecutorial machine. And I would suspect to the point that we're not even truly able to get our information across in a meaningful way to judges and juries. I mean, we'll be left with our recourse to the press, which is to try to explain the hacker ethos in that, you know, information wants to be free. The internet needs to be free. That it should be privacy for the individuals and transparency for corporations and governments. That's one portion of it. You know, the other portion is they're spying on us. You know, we have the right to go in and see what they're doing, what they're saying. And then there's the third component of a hacker ethos, which is, you know what, these big corporations, these governments, especially the United States government, they're bullies. And, you know, what do you do to a bully? The only thing you can do, you punch it right in the nose. And some of these hacks have done that, and I don't see a Trump administration reacting very well to a punch in the nose.
That's exactly right. I think there's an issue of embarrassment, and it's sort of how one way you judge the quality of a person is how they react to that. And I think that we're seeing a puerile level of response to things that are perceived as an affront to an individual. I just can't let you go without mentioning that you are a founding member of the Whistleblowers Defense League, such an important topic that really dovetails with what we've been discussing. Can you quickly tell us a bit about that before we say goodbye?
Sure. The Whistleblowers Defense League is a very diffuse network of attorneys that you can Google us on the net, go to it, it'll give you a number of one of the attorneys to call, and depending upon where the case is, it would be our desire, if we're able to take on the case pro bono, which, you know, to those unfamiliar means for free, and to go ahead and try to defend the rights of whistleblowers to tell the truth.
Jay Lederman, it's been such a pleasure to chat with you from California. Really, kudos on your amazing body of work defending democracy and hacktivists, and we hope to have you on again.
Well, thank you. I've had a lot of fun. I really appreciate the interview.
Thanks, Jay. Take care. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. In the past decade, we've seen an unprecedented attack on hackers, journalists, whistleblowers, and other so-called information activists who dare to let the public know what goes on within the corridors of corporate and governmental power structures. Yet it's clear to most, especially in light of a number of high-profile prosecutions, that we have a diminishing right to privacy, especially digital privacy. Here to discuss this issue and to forecast what activists can expect during the Trump administration is New York City Attorney Abi Hassan. Abi is the former Mass Defense Coordinator at the National Lawyers Guild and is now co-founder of the Black Movement Law Project. Abi Hassan, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Abi, you worked on hacking-related public education and defense years before the recent allegations of Russia hacking the DNC. Let's start by defining hacktivists, and if you will, clarify the difference between hackers and leakers.
Well, you know, hacker is one of those terms that has a lot of definitions. I think in the common parlance, it's generally thought of as someone who breaks into computer systems, but amongst people who self-describe as hackers, it's actually generally referred to as someone who's interested in computer systems or someone who likes to mess around with technology. So you often will get a disconnect between the popular discourse and the kind of inside IT or inside the computer world discourse.
And hacktivists?
Hacktivist is basically just taking the word hacker and smashing it into the word activist. So a hacktivist is someone who uses hacking to advance activism. And, you know, that's another one of those terms that people self-describe and will have different outcomes depending on what the individual hacktivists are doing. One person's hacktivist is another person's cyber terrorist.
We often see hackers and leakers in terms of terms used interchangeably. Barrett Brown, for example, uploaded a link, so I guess he was a leaker.
And this is part of the problem with the general misunderstanding of technology by law enforcement and by the kind of government entities that are charged with enforcing the laws. So Barrett Brown is charged as a hacker, and he literally used no technical expertise whatsoever. So, and there's an advantage to the government to having that ambiguity because hacker scares people. So they can say someone's a hacker, it'll scare people, and then you don't ever get to the real issue of what's going on, which is in Barrett Brown's case, basically the act of journalism against, you know, powerful private military complex. So.
And we should clarify, Barrett Brown is an award-winning journalist who created a site called PM, Project PM. He was very, and continues to be very, interested in the intersection between government and corporate surveillance, and just recently was released from prison into a halfway house in Texas for computer-related, activist-related charges. Well, several years ago, after Aaron Swartz killed himself, you wrote an article that got really widespread attention. In it, you said, we're all criminals like Aaron. Can you talk about what you meant by that and in what context?
Well, Aaron Swartz was someone who I admired, and his suicide kind of hit me really hard. So, you know, it got me thinking about the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and how broad a prosecution under that legislation can be. And so what I was pointing out was that when you make a law that is so broad that people's everyday seemingly innocent activity, such as the violation of a terms of service agreement, which is something that prosecutors have used, have used a theory that is a violation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. When you make something that widespread illegal, you basically get to choose who is a criminal and who isn't based on whatever arbitrary factors you decide as a prosecutor. So that's kind of what I was pointing out, that everyone is a criminal. If the law can be so vague and prosecution can be so arbitrary, we are all criminals.
And essentially that there are so many thousands of laws actually on the books, many of them antiquated, that at any time, if a particular action or ideology falls into disfavor with the government, that's when they can choose to engage in what we call selective prosecution. And a reminder that every day everyone is literally agreeing with hundreds of users' agreement every time you use your computer to buy something, play a game, access a service. And Aaron, we discussed in a segment with attorney Jay Lederman, was basically a student at MIT who was downloading publicly available documents on the website JSTOR, academic documents, to make them widely available to more people, right?
Well, I mean, that was the prosecution's theory. I don't, right. He had written about that, but he had not actually released any documents.
Right.
But he was prosecuted nonetheless for downloading those documents.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, again, it was his political presence that made him a target. It was his activism that made him a target.
Because he had created many different open source software and worked on Reddit, for example.
Yeah, and he led a fight against SOPA and PIPA, which were these draconian laws to kind of crank down on internet freedom. So he was very visibly an internet freedom activist. And that's literally what made him a target.
What is important to know about other hackers, such as Jeremy Hammond? We've talked about Aaron and Barrett Brown. But what do these individuals represent in terms of what they're fighting for?
You know, I think that we have different cases with all of those people. But the real point that comes through is how incredibly harshly they're treated for activities on the internet that would seem to be, and basically every other country in the world agrees, are not the kind of thing that would require us to put someone in prison for decades, right? I mean, obviously, we are the mass incarceration nation where we put people in prison for longer and for smaller things than, I mean, you know, we have the largest prison population of any country in the history of the world, probably. So, but the connection of looking at these people and the way they're treated is scary, because it's saying that people who are advocating for a free and open internet and who are committing acts of akin to civil disobedience, who are releasing information, are considered to be basically tantamount to terrorists. I mean, and you can see that even today with the way this Russia hacking thing is being completely overblown, and people are running around screaming about basically low-level espionage. But because we've been built up this framework about being scared of hackers, and rather than understanding, we're told to be scared.
Abhi, do you have any thoughts about President-elect Trump's about-face with respect to his opinion of Julian Assange and WikiLeaks?
To me, it's unsurprising that Trump would support someone one day and not support them the next day, depending on what they're saying. And then that's kind of, I think what's more telling with the reaction to WikiLeaks is the response of people, the kind of Democratic Party partisans who are saying that WikiLeaks is the devil at this point, because they see WikiLeaks as being implicated against Hillary Clinton. And like, you know, I don't want to get into all the details. Like, WikiLeaks has a lot of things that I don't agree with, but like, when you're releasing actual information, things that people actually said, and you get this hardline response, that's generally not based on a rational, sober analysis of that information. It's much more of a partisan, just reactionary response.
Well, speaking of President-elect Trump, Abhi, what are your predictions for the climate that information activists will be facing over the next few years? Is it going to get worse?
It's hard to tell first. I mean, I have to preface, I'm not going to give any concrete predictions. I think, you know, there's a few trends that worry me that I think that we should be looking out for. The first thing is this, the continuation of, you know, the encryption wars. You know, we've been through this once in the 90s, and we're going through it again now, where law enforcement and government factions are going after the right to encrypt, the right to privacy in your own communications. And so that's going to continue. And I think we really have seen it slowly start to build on all fronts in terms of Rule 41 was implemented last year of the federal rules, which allows CFAA, in a CFAA case, allows a judge to issue a warrant, basically allows the government to hack into computers, even of people whose computers are not suspected of being involved in a crime, but they're part of a botnet. So, you know, it's those kind of creeping things where they say it's for something really bad that we're doing this very intrusive thing, but then there's an inevitable creep. So from the judicial branch, we see that, you know, the executive branch attempted to pass the Burr-Feinstein last year. That was a really terrible law that basically you know, going after our ability to encrypt and forcing companies to give over information and to create backdoors.
Backdoors so that corporations and the government could access encrypted information so it wouldn't be secure.
Exactly. And then we also see a burgeoning kind of movement to that because these there hasn't been some kind of draconian federal measure, we see it coming in from the states. So there's different approaches from different places. I, you know, a few months ago, or maybe South Carolina, I think, had a bill. It didn't pass, but they sent it to a committee that was nominally fighting obscenity, but it would require that any device sold in South Carolina either have an obscenity filter, undefined, right, which is a, you know, a problem because it's forcing a technology company to create something for the government's purpose. But the law said that if you don't put this obscenity filter on, then you can either do that or pay a fee, right? You know, you see these things coming from different places. California tried to pass something recently, you know, so and New York is another place to look out for. New York City, Cy Vance, has, you know, this list of all these iPhones that are unencrypted and wants.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So the,
meaning the, brands that are unencrypted.
They can't get at the iPhone, right?
Right.
I'm saying to look out for not just federal legislation, but also states, like the states and even localities sometimes are trying to, you know, it's like a trial balloon. They're trying to get things through so that they can basically fight this crypto war for, you know, on the government's behalf.
What is the government's goal vis-a-vis encryption? They don't want private individuals to be able to communicate in ways that they can't intercept.
Up until very recently, most of our internet-based communications have been transmitted in what you call clear text, right? So they're not encrypted, that anyone who gets a hold of that communication or who intercepts it can just read what you say, right? Think of a text message, something like that, right?
A third party can read it.
Exactly. And basically what's happened since the kind of dawn of digital communication until basically the last few years has been the government has basically gotten fat and lazy because they can get information if they want it, right? The converse of that is that criminals can get information, right? And so we see an exploding number of bad guy hackers, right? Of people, of criminals who are trying to steal money, steal identities, you know, steal information from companies. There's been an explosion of that, right? Law enforcement thinks that they can separate those, that we can allow encryption, but we can do it in a way that lets the government see it and doesn't let the bad guys see it. And the technology community broadly has, you know, responded in almost unanimity that that is not possible, that if you break the encryption, you break it totally.
Right.
So the encryption wars, that's what that is about, right?
And also, isn't there an argument by technology experts that the whole infrastructure is actually more secure if you have encryption?
We're going to see more attempts to compromise that data, right? So we're going to see, you know, Facebook, Google, Apple are the big targets, right? Because these are big mediators of massive communication. And in some sense, that's a tough battle to fight, right? Because we're basically saying, we're going to rely on you, Facebook, to say that when we say we're private, we really are, right? And I think at the end of the day, that's not a winning battle. But where we really have to worry is when they start limiting what applications we use. If they say, oh, you can't use a popular text messaging app, it's called Signal, that right. It provides private communication that doesn't go through Apple or Google or anything. That's when it gets really scary. But right now, I think a lot of people think that they are communicating privately on Facebook.
Abhi, we've heard a lot in the last few months about various lists being put together, whether it's of Muslim Americans. We certainly know from our work at the National Lawyers Guild that different activists, environmental, animal rights were being monitored by the government. What kinds of concerns do you have about the trend of starting to keep lists of various Americans?
I think overall this is a trend that we really should be looking out for, right? Because there has been a lot of attention given to Trump's Muslim registry, right? Which is, you know, if you think about these kind of lists, I categorize them, there's involuntary lists and there's voluntary lists. And you have this category of involuntary lists where, which is just, you know, it's just information, right? Like the Muslim registry is one example, the no-fly list, the terrorist watch list. All of these things are ways of taking away individual rights through ostensibly some kind of process, rational process, like Obama had a kill list, right, where they had people they would kill. So like
by drones.
Yeah. So we're literally meting out law of all sorts through basically lists of that are only accountable within the agencies, right? They're not accountable to the public, right? It took 7 or 8 years for the ACLU to find out, for the FBI to admit that the no-fly list existed, right? So we have these categories that we're thinking of these involuntary lists. The massive data collection of biometrics is another one, right? So if you get arrested in New York, they'll take an iris scan.
DNA collection,
all that stuff, right? So that, in effect, is a list of people who have been arrested. You don't have to be convicted to be arrested. You could be just walking down the street in the wrong place at the right time, on the wrong time, and be put on a list. Another really important one to look out for that there's been a lot of activism in California about is a gang list, right? They created in 1988 under the rubric of terrorism, street terrorism, they called it, basically a list of gangs. And so you have a tattoo, you get on the list. You live in a particular neighborhood, you get on the list. You are in the car with someone who has the tattoo and lives in the neighborhood, you're an associate, right? So
And can I add something? Because in New York, last spring, we did a segment on this. It was called the Bronx 120. The government is now using RICO prosecutions to go after young persons in public housing complexes. And what they're doing is combing through social media to see who knows who in a tight neighborhood.
Correct.
And they're sweeping those individuals up in gang prosecutions.
That's a really good point, right? You know, you look at some of these indictments and it'll say 33 boys. And then you ask these guys, what are the 33 boys that are labeled as a gang in a federal indictment? And it's like, oh, they live at number 33. It's the guys that live at number 33. Right. And so we see those things infiltrate society. But I also want to point out that we also have voluntary lists that we're creating, right? Like Facebook, for example, is creating a social map of your activist network or of your friend network, right? A really big issue is, you know, in sanctuary cities that have created their own IDs, such as New York, that's some information that has the names and addresses of undocumented people, right?
Right.
You know, and others, right? I have one of those New York City ID cards. I'm not undocumented. But the Dream Act, right? The Dreamers list, And then another one that I think that's worth thinking about is like this TSA pre. We're like starting to create as a society the good people lists,
yes.
Right? Where it's like, oh, I've been vetted.
Right.
I've been secured. And, you know, we think of these things oftentimes. I think people look at these things as objective. Without a political lens, you look at it as neutral. But, you know, especially under a Trump administration, the concern is, when these things become weaponized, what happens, right? That's one of the big things that I kind of, the development of these kind of good and bad guy lists is very concerning to me.
Because a good guy list could change at any point.
Is that the society we want to live in? Where if you go through a background check, you know, we already have 5 million people with security clearances. That's a class of society, literally, right? That is a class of society that has special access that the rest of us don't have. The more we create that, I think it's just definitionally the less freedom we have as a society.
Okay, so we have the crypto wars and lists. I think you had a third concern.
Well, I think another broad concern that really plays into these other things is this continued corporate consolidation of our communications. Think about cell phones, right? Cell phones are people's primary source of communication. It's a duopoly. There's Apple and Google. When we're talking about broadband, there's just, there's this giant Time Warner impending merger. When we think about wireless, which is how most people get the internet, there, Sprint, T-Mobile want to merge. When you create these giant monopolies, it's just that much easier to inject the back doors or to create the mechanisms for mass surveillance. I mean, and we know these companies are compliant. So the more consolidation they have, the less, right now we have Apple saying, hey, we offer security, but it's like, that's kind of a whim of theirs at this point. Obviously they have business interests and other factors that play into their calculus, but do we want our privacy subjected to the whim of these mega corporations?
Abhi, our listeners are probably wondering what, if anything, they can do to protect themselves. As an information security trainer, can you share your tips?
Yeah, I think that there's two things, Roy. I mean, the one is the nuts and bolts of protecting your digital security. We can't go into all the details here, but I can give you some resources that will point you in the right direction.
We can link to those.
And two, I think that it's really important to start building communities and building organization, right? And getting together and learning kind of the digital security nuts and bolts is one way to do that. But we're not going to be able to effectively fight back without really creating new spaces and new organizations and bringing new people into awareness and activism. Because, frankly, we're losing, right? So the forces of opposition have been building for years and years and have their own media. They have their own nonprofits. They have huge swaths of, they have lots of money, right? So in terms of the digital security, I think it's important to learn, but it's also important to evangelize, to reach out to friends and family, to go. One of the places you can do is a crypto party in New York.
What is a crypto party?
A crypto party is basically just, it's like a teach-in kind of, like it's where people get together and teach each other how to use cryptography and digital security tools. So there's a couple good places, resources in New York. There's Crypto Harlem that's on Meetup that you can find if you just go to meetup.org, I believe, and find Crypto Harlem. And there's actually under the New York Crypto Party Network, and there'll be postings there. There's also a group in Brooklyn, NYC Resistor is a hacker space, and they're having their first crypto party of the year on January 28th. If you go to cryptoparty.in/NYC, you'll see there's another crypto party for environmental journalists on the 23rd. Search around for crypto party.
And anyone can go to a crypto party. You don't have to be a technical wizard, lay people. That's the point.
The point is that anyone can go and you teach and share. And I want to just emphasize that we need to start thinking of these things as community building, and organization building and creating those networks of resistance.
Right. Right. This is important information to share right now.
When we're talking about any of these things, when we're talking about activism, we're talking about encryption, that the strength is in numbers, right? And so many more people are starting to recognize that privacy is important, even if you don't have something particular, even if you don't have anything particular embarrassing or whatever, that it's important, because if you lose it, it's gone. And so I would encourage people to start, learn how to use Signal, learn how to use these tools, and teach others, teach your family, because this really, the strength is in numbers.
Abhi Hassan, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.